You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Well, we were supposed to have the renowned author Lemony Snicket on the show this week, the author of 13 novels and a series of unfortunate events and many other great books that everyone loves, including his latest called Poison for Breakfast, which is highly amusing. But apparently Mr. Snicket could not join us today and sent a representative in his place, a person called Daniel Handler, of whom I can safely say he is mostly water. Daniel Handler, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm sorry it's already a disappointment.
I was a middle school teacher for a long time, so I know how popular Lemony Snicket's books are. And I also know that there are films and TV shows that are wonderful. I found Poison for Breakfast not only very funny, but serious as well. I mean, it's been a long time between books for Mr. Snicket. So is this book the culmination of some thoughts that have been rattling around the Snicket mind for some time?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. The book took a somewhat circuitous and long route to publication, partially because, as you say, it has a lot of serious ideas bandied about in it. And it was also, it took me a while before I could really figure out if it was a book. It was an idea and I kept writing it down, but it took a while to decide, yes, this is in fact a book. This isn't merely my compulsive rambling on legal pads.
Do you write in longhand?
I do, yeah. I don't like the machine that I use to work to be also my mailbox and my television and my numerous temptations, my catalog, whatever else.
You give it to distraction.
Yeah. So I like to write longhand and then make outrageous pronouncements elsewhere on screen rather than try to combine them.
And has that always been true? Did you write all of your books on the legal pads?
No, I started when I had a baby. And the baby was very distracting, as babies are. And so I started to work outside of the house. I would leave my house and go places to work so as not to be distracted by the baby. The baby, I should add, was left in the care of responsible adults. I didn't just abandon the baby. The baby's fine now.
That's good to know.
He's not even a baby anymore. So that's how well it went. I would go and leave the house and work in a cafe or a library. And then I began to have that problem when you drink tea all day long and you're working on your laptop of what to do when it's time to go to use the bathroom. If you take the laptop with you, you look suspicious. And if you ask a stranger, if you say, I'm afraid this machine will be stolen by a stranger, so I'm asking you, a stranger, to watch over this machine. It doesn't help. So I began to write longhand because nobody steals a legal pad. And then I really liked it. I found the burden of being on screen was such a wonderful thing to relieve myself of. So I really enjoy it.
You just mentioned a moment ago that you have a child who is now 17 years old.
Yes.
So it's been a while since you started publishing your series of unfortunate events. And I think that a lot of little kids who grew up with them are now adults. I mean, adults approach me all the time and say, aren't you Mr. Shapiro? You were my teacher when I was in the seventh grade. So is that happening to you that children who grew up on your books are now?
No, hardly anyone calls me Mr. Shapiro. I do meet increasingly numbers of people who read my books when they were young who are no longer of any dismissible adult age. For a while, they said, I read your work when I was growing up, and I would think to myself, but you're not really done growing up, are you? But now they have children and, responsible employment. They have books of their own, and so I can no longer pretend that they are young people. They're clearly old people.
And it just feels like yesterday that you started writing in some ways.
No, it feels like 1,000 years ago that I started writing, honestly. So that's okay, too. And then also, I live in San Francisco where I grew up. And so when I'm recognized, it's just as likely to be, yeah, my sister dumped you in 10th grade. I remember you. So it's a nice check on one's ego that I'm subject to being recognized for an assortment of non-glamorous reasons.
Poison for Breakfast, your new book, or Lemony Snicket's new book, I should say. It really feels like it's spontaneous, you know, like you're just speaking to me. But you reveal in the book that you really labor over every sentence and that there's a good deal of editing. So is it challenging to maintain that kind of casual voice?
I mean, I would say that that's the central challenge of writing literature. I don't think there are too many authors who would like to be ponderous in their prose style. I think they would all like to feel that everything makes sense and that it's moving along at the right clip. I think that's the central challenge of it. And so I had all these little pieces that I would write and then put together in different ways and try to smooth them out. And then I like to put things aside for a while and not look at it. And so then maybe the stitching will seem invisible. You've mentioned that you teach film, which I think is probably a similar thing. Having been in the editing room on rough drafts of films, then when you have a new draft, all you see is all that you've changed. You know, yeah. You see the little edits and you have to get a little away from it and then watch it and say, oh, I don't miss that at all. We cut out that whole scene, which at the time seemed very crucial, but now seems utterly like half remembered. So I try to do that with my prose as well, to try to get it moving gracefully and lightly.
And you've had this, not only the experience of having your work turned into film, but you've written the films as well.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do. It's collaborative, and which can be very challenging, particularly if you're used to being alone someplace working on your legal pad. But it feels good for the brain. And I've always liked film. And so I thought I might contribute to that art form, however meagerly.
I think everything has been very well received. And you've even had, you've done certain things twice, right? You had a film version of Unfortunate Events and a TV version.
Yes, I've done a lot of things twice. But that's but adapting a series of unfortunate events for film and then television is maybe the highest profile thing I've done twice. yeah, and that was... it was a challenge both times, building a whole world of Snicket and Baudelaire orphans on a set that you can film is, of course, a tremendous expense. And anytime someone's in charge of a tremendous expense, they're really worried. So you have to deal with kind of worried corporate types alongside the ordinary collaborative creative argument. Which is a challenge and something that doesn't happen in a book, even though some books are maybe more expensive to publish than others. You know, if you say, and then they go up the stairs in a book, it doesn't cost you any more than if they merely open the door.
This book, Poison for Breakfast, it's kind of like a textbook for writers. I mean, you gave a lot of writing advice in the book.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, it's been suggested to me before that I try to write a book about writing, but I don't like books about writing. they're generally irritating and they feel phony even when maybe they're not. And the best writing advice that I have gotten is from listening and reading when authors talk about what they do, but not necessarily in order to teach you it. They just might kind of try to explain themselves. And I think that's often really fascinating. So I thought that if there was a sideways way to talk a little bit about how I make books, that maybe that would be interesting for some people.
There are many great gags in this book, and I don't want to give any of them away, but I do love it when you said, there are things that I left out of this book, and then you told us the things that you left out, therefore not leaving them out.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's just like we were saying. I mean, it is true. I put some things in the book and then I cut them out. And I've, over the years, I think I've become sufficiently callous that I can cut things from the book and not mourn them. But every so often there's something where I think, oh, but that was lovely. And I, you know, then I have to have an argument with myself, not unlike the arguments I've had with collaborators, where I say, it doesn't matter how lovely it is, it doesn't belong there. And I say, but I really like it. Okay. And then I settle it with myself. So I thought mentioning some of the things I cut would be a way of at least having my cake and eat it too, I believe is the expression I'm looking for.
Your book is hilariously funny, really, truly funny. And it's, you're a comedian as well as an author, and there's some great running gags. Is that like an instinct to know when to put your running gag in and not overdo it or underdo it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was raised in a pretty funny family. I guess the word I'm looking for is Jewish. And so, you know, my sister and I in the backs of cars of when we were going places and around the dinner table, you know, we soon learned that a joke that isn't that funny becomes a little funnier when you say it two times, and then it becomes quite funny when you say it six or seven times, and then suddenly stops being funny and you try to make sure that you say it that one perfect last time.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of practice in the rhythm of that. I don't think of myself as a comedian at all, because I think that's a super admirable and interesting forum in which I cannot compete or really even participate. I think I'm just funny for a writer, which is a nice low level to be at.
There have been some very funny writers.
Sure. But it's just, it actually reminds me of when the first season of the Netflix show was being released and it was eligible for various awards. Netflix wanted to put it in the comedy category. They wanted it to compete in the comedy category rather than in the kind of family or children's category. And I said, I don't think that's going to work, because it's only funny. It's more funny than maybe you expect if what you've heard is that you're going to watch something with your child that's about terrible things happening to orphans, then it's pretty funny. But once you put it next to shows that are trying to make you laugh every 20 seconds, it's not going to compete. And sure enough, it didn't. And then the next year they said, why don't we put it in the family category? And then all of a sudden we were delightfully funny for our genre. So I think I'm kind of the same way.
What were, do your influences include comedians as well as writers, or who are your influences?
Oh, my influences. I mean, I don't think any of them are comedians, you know, in terms of like a stand-up comedian or something like that. Although, you know, exposed to early doses of Monty Python and Woody Allen, if we're still allowed to mention his name.
Sure.
At a young age, I think we're pretty formative. But for the Snicket books, I would say it was really Roald Dahl was the big one. Mm-hmm. Sylvia Keely Snyder. And then Edward Gorey, whose strange little books turned up in my house and were so mysterious to me. And I liked the kind of deadpan mystery. I like where humor and mystery sit next to each other. I think that's interesting because that feels like life.
Which reminds me that there are some delightful illustrations in Poison for Breakfast. Who did these drawings?
Her name is Margot Kent. Yeah, she's quite elegant. The publisher found her, so I can't take credit for it. Although, also, the publisher isn't going on all these podcasts, so maybe I should just start taking credit
for
it.
Sure, of course.
What do they know? Yes. Margot Kent, I plucked her out of the unknown. I made her. I taught her how to draw. She'd never drawn anything before. And I said, well, why don't you try a little artwork? And then before you know it, look at her now, Margot Kent. No, she's terrific. And her illustrations have a lovely handmade quality to them. And being as the book to me feels that way, it's a little private in its thought, and it's all about little scraps of paper and thinking about things, I thought it was nice to have the illustrations similarly have the appearance of being dashed off. And I think she's doing kind of what you talked about. She creates the illusion that she just rattled off this illustration in a couple of seconds. But I'm married to an illustrator, so I know that even when it looks like it's been rattled off very quickly, that actually it's been worked on.
Well, the person that you're married to, were they upset that you had chosen someone else to illustrate your book?
No, my wife and I have collaborated on a number of books and collaborated with other people. We are in that way, we are non-monogamous.
Have an open marriage.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're chatting this week with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket. He's the author of 13 volumes of a series of unfortunate events, several picture books, including The Dark and The Bad Mood and the Stick, and the books collectively titled All the Wrong Questions. His new book is called Poison for Breakfast.
Daniel Handler, tell us a little bit about, if you don't mind going over old stories, how did Lemony Snicket come into existence in the first place?
Well, it was a name and a little bit of a persona very early on, before I ever thought I would write for children. My first novel, The Basic Eight, makes fun of some right-wing organizations and news sources. And one thing that I liked to do when I was writing the novel was that I would call various right-wing organizations and news places, and I would ask them to mail me their materials. And so I can mock them. And then one woman said to me, "Oh, of course, we'd happily mail you some materials. What is your name?" And when she said, "What is your name?" I immediately thought, "Don't say your actual name." Which I think is another part of being raised Jewish. I thought, don't get your list on this name of right-wing monsters. And so I said something else other than my name. And what I said was Lemony Snicket. And I liked having that name around. And so I began to write cranky letters to the editors of different papers and signing them Lemony Snicket. My friends for one birthday gave me some business cards that said Lemony Snicket. And so I used to go to bars and say that I would give them out. I would say I was in rhetoric. Sometimes I said I was a yacht lawyer, which was a phrase that I had read someplace. And I would explain that I spoke up for the interests of the yacht, like not the owner, but I spoke for the yacht. And when they said in what kind of cases, I would say international waters mostly, which seemed like a safe thing to do. They never said anything like, "I wonder why this guy with a PJ Harvey t-shirt and jeans in a bar who looks maybe 23 years old has found successful employment in any way whatsoever." They never said that. They just had questions about my yacht lawyerdom. So when I started writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, it seemed interesting to me to keep that mystery that had inspired me from Edward Gorey and other books like that, to keep that intact. And so then I began to think that it would be fun to publish the books under the name of the narrator. And I had this name lying around already indulging in, nefarious and suspicious activities.
Well, so when you first started to write the series of unfortunate events, so I had a friend who wrote a book for Scholastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was called Great Sports Thrills. And he had never written for them before, but he'd written other things, and then he wrote for them.
There's something about that title that sounds redundant, but I can't figure out what it is. Great Sports Thrills.
Yeah.
And they
sent it back to him, and they said, "We love this book, but you have too many big words. Can you break up all, and you don't use this word and don't use that word?"
Right. So it was originally called, like, Tremendous Sports Thrills.
So did you get any of that? Did they say things like, I mean, obviously, it's the themes are not the kinds of themes that children books had in the past, and so there must have been obvious objections there. But what about just like the wording and things like that? In other words, tell me what happened.
It was a real blessing. It was a time of expansion and creativity in children's literature and in children's publishing. And so the short answer was that they left us alone. My editor was young then. Our designer, Alison Donnelly, was also young and new, and I had been paid what seemed I was most grateful for at the time, but seemed to HarperCollins a pittance. And so kind of as far as they were concerned, if I wanted to try to update the Gothic novel for young people and use as much kind of namby-pamby words as I preferred, that was on me. They wished the best of luck to me. And if it didn't work out as they suspected, then there'd be no hard feelings all around. So that was really the short answer. And it's something that I carry with me, that you can make a lot of magic by leaving people alone. So sometimes when I have the audacity to be in charge of other artists, or at least in a kind of influential situation with them, I try to create a space where they can work in peace. And I am appreciative of publishing situations that do that. We're in a more conservative time now, for sure, in children's publishing, certainly in the States and many places abroad. And one of the reasons why Poison for Breakfast is out later than someone might think is because it took a while to find a publishing house that was up for a book that was so wool gathery and that takes on a lot of serious themes. That seemed like a scary thing. And it reminded me that in 1998, when I was working on A Series of Unfortunate Events, if the same forces had been at work, I don't know how those books would have been published.
So that's very interesting. Even though you have published so many books, both as Daniel Handler and Lemony Snicket, there was you couldn't just go back to the people who had had so much success with Lemony Snicket and say, I have a new book, and they didn't just jump up and down and go, oh boy.
There was some jumping. No, I mean, in the case of this book, there were some concerns. But that's, I mean, throughout my career, there's been one concern one place or another, so I'm not really used to that. But what I do have the luxury and privilege of doing, having published so many books, is to work with people who aren't afraid. That seems like the healthiest way to go to me. And so I try to avoid people who are frightened as often as possible.
You mentioned extreme right-wing outlets that you frequented as Lemony Snicket for.
Well, they seemed extreme in the 90s. Nowadays, yeah, now they would be considered, you know, center-left.
Well, things have changed a lot. But your books are not... do you think that there's politics or political ideas in your books?
Well, I mean, not much aside from the fact that basically all books are political, right? Books are actually, they're usually advocating for the status quo, or they're advocating for something to be changed. So I think you can find political meaning, for instance, in the Baudelaires, who are ostracized by society, who encounter deeper and deeper corruption wherever they go and can't really find a safe space to be who they are and have that be their central struggle. I think you can find political meaning in that, but I don't think you can find, you know, endorsements of political candidates or reminding people to vote for local ordinances or anything like that.
So you didn't see it as an allegory for, you know, the Bush administration or anything like that?
No, and I've been, you know, adopted and rejected over the years by various ideologies. You know, I'm either, I'm often simultaneously clearly advocating and clearly offended by whatever idea it is that people are finding in there. So that feels just about right to me.
were there any large numbers of people who just didn't get what you were doing and said, this guy should be stopped and this book shouldn't be in our schools? And
I wouldn't say large numbers. There were some determined numbers. There still are. And that's something that's changed in the landscape as well. It used to be that librarians for young people could be counted on to kind of stay the course in terms of free expression. Mm-hmm. Now they're more likely to be the people who are advocating for taking books off shelves. And so that still happens, but it's not large numbers. If it were large numbers, then it would kind of mean something. It tends to be small groups of fanatical people who see an opportunity to grab a little power.
Yeah. Interesting. So have you had a lot of experiences with, and I'm sure you did. Have you gone to schools and met with kids? And
oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have. It's something I enjoy doing. I like looking at a school. You know, I kind of, one of my favorite parts is often waiting in some classroom or some hallway where the event has yet to begin. And then I get to see the second grade papers posted or the, you know, eighth grade projects or anything like that. That's interesting to me. I was kind of hiding in the sex ed classroom once in order to go into the gymnasium. The sex ed classroom was right off the gymnasium, which felt kind of iffy to me already. But there was a fishbowl where you could ask questions anonymously. And so, of course, I read all of the anonymous questions. And by the time I'd read two or three, I already had an idea for a book, which was All the Dirty Parts, which was another book that was looked like it was going to be published for young people, and then people got nervous and it was published elsewhere. But so yeah, I like visiting a school, if only to gather information, but I also like to meet people who are interested in reading my books. I try to look for the people who seem genuinely enthused rather than the people who have been assigned to be enthused, which I think is something I can kind of smell. I often think of this time where I did a presentation for some young people and they were kind of rowdy, which I don't mind because I don't work there. But but afterwards, the principal said to them and then to me, "I'm sorry they didn't act like adults."
Well, they're not supposed to.
Yeah, so first of all, they're not adults. So there's that. You can say that to a gazelle, too. "I'm sorry you're not acting like an adult." But what I thought was more striking was that I actually thought they were acting like adults, that if you gathered a bunch of adults in the middle of their workday and you said, "You have to come into a room and you have to sit on the floor," and then you said, like, "Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Franzen," whatever you said, someone who some people were interested in, but a lot of people would think, "I was just in the middle of something else. Why do I have to sit here on the floor and listen to Jonathan Franzen?" And that's how adults would act. They'd be good for a couple of minutes and then they'd get bored.
Yes. Well, I teach a class. I have to be careful what I say, but I teach a class with a lot of older people at another place. And all the older people are always looking at their phones. Like, right. They're 80 and they're still looking at their phones.
Yeah. Yeah, I try not to look at my phone at all. I held off from getting a phone for so long because of the kind of distraction that I've been talking about.
Yeah.
And whenever I catch myself looking at it, and it's that horrible thing where you kind of want something to be there, and then when something's there, you know, you don't get an email that says, "Look under your chair right now. I've left you like a homemade cherry pie." You only get an email that says, "I would like you to do something for me." Or that thing that you tried to do has not worked out. There's a complication and we need some action from you on that as well. And so you end up kind of praying for communication, and then it's not the communication you want.
Yeah.
It's not someone saying, "We've invented a time machine and we're sending you back in time and you're going to be a member of Roxy Music, just like you always wanted to be." That's not the email you get. You don't get that.
Roxy Music, they were great. I loved them.
Yeah.
I spent a day with Brian Eno once. He was terrific.
Oh, yeah? I'm envious of you. I admire him a lot.
Oh, he's amazing.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're chatting this week with Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, the author of 13 volumes in A Series of Unfortunate Events, several picture books, including The Dark and The Bad Mood and The Stick, and the books collectively titled All the Wrong Questions. Daniel Handler's new book is Poison for Breakfast by Lemony Snicket.
So what kind of a kid were you? Were you a good student?
I was a good student, yeah. School came pretty easily for me, I think is probably a better way to put that. There's nothing like having a kid who's in school and having his own, you know, the shape of his own education goes a different way to make you think more about your own school. And I did very well in school, but I think actually it's because it came naturally to me and that I was lucky enough to be in schools where they could support me and have enthusiasm for me where I was. But yeah, I like to read a lot. Literature meant a lot to me. It has always meant a lot to me. And so that was my most frequent companion. But I do seem to be one of the few writers who doesn't remember high school as an unending parade of gloom and terror. I had some friends. We had dinner parties. Sometimes we had a pretty good time.
And so when you started to write for kids, did you picture yourself as a child reading this book? Or did you just say, "Oh, this will be fun"?
I sort of pictured myself. I thought about what I liked. And I tried to go into that space. I mean, because I don't think there's any other way to do it, really. I don't think you can research and pedagogy your way into writing something that young people like. You can do that and publish something, but I don't think you can find the kind of instinctive delight that happens with different readers in different books. And so I think the only kind of reader I could really chase down was the kind of reader that I was. And there turned out to be way more of them than I had anticipated.
What will you do? Will there ever be any more unfortunate events books, or what's
I like that you said books, it sounded for a minute. Will there ever be any more unfortunate events? And I thought, yes, out of all the times in history, surely we can assume that there's going to be at least a couple more.
No, we're done with this.
Yeah, that's right. There'll be no more, say, I don't know, variations. A series of unfortunate events is over as a series, but I plan certainly on writing more books as Lemony Snicket as much as I do as Daniel Handler. I find it an interesting space to inhabit. And I think you never love a book the way you love a book when you're 10. And so when you're interested in literature and interested in reading, I think that's a pretty crucial space to have some fun in.
Well, Poison for Breakfast seems like a book that, I found it amusing and delightful, but I can't see any reason why someone who is 12 wouldn't also enjoy it. Did you intend this book for all ages?
I think it is really a piece of children's literature at heart, if you think of children's literature as a genre, which is how I picture it. Uh-huh. You know, I don't think just because an 11-year-old likes something that it becomes a piece of children's literature. I think children's literature is a thing. And I think that all good children's literature can be read by adults. But certainly, for instance, in the packaging, we tried to work on a cover that if you were a grown-up and you were reading it on the subway, you wouldn't be ashamed to be seen with it. I think often with children's literature, there's very beautiful books to be read, but if there's like a bug-eyed talking animal on the cover of your book, you have to be a pretty brave 45-year-old to carry that into the conference room before your big meeting starts. So I think there was an eye for making it more immediately appealing to a wider age range. But I've always had grown-up appreciators of my work. So that's not very new to me.
There I was guess a period because of parents time, read their book, parents read your books out loud to their kids.
Well, right. I mean, that's kind of the whole gambit of children's literature anyway, right? Is particularly books for very young people. You have to kind of attract an imaginary parent of an imaginary reader. It's like an extra layer of, imaginary fact finding before you can put ink to paper. And at the beginning, I just remember that I would meet these adults who would say, oh, I brought like my friend's niece, but I really like your work. There'd be these, it's almost like you had to show ID, you had to bring a child. And sometimes and then as everyone got older in that first generation of readers, I think people finally said, you know what? I don't have to apologize for enjoying the wide window. I think I'm right here. So I appreciate that too.
Well, then you did your job as a writer for young adults, because I can tell you that I taught middle school in Salinas, California, and most of my students thought of reading as a chore to be avoided at all costs. They don't like
it. Well, we tend to teach it that way.
Yeah. And so when there was a series of unfortunate events on my desk, kids really wanted to read those. And that's an amazing thing that kids wanted to read anything.
Well, thank you. It is a blessing. I usually fault the teacher. I like that you had copies of a book that they just might happen to enjoy on their desk.
I would tell them not to touch them if those were my books.
Yeah, that's what my parents used to do. They used to read to me. They would stop at a suspenseful moment, and then they would say, time for bed, and they would put the book there, and then there would be a flashlight. And then the next day, if the bookmark had moved 20 pages, they would just read as if they didn't know the difference. And I was getting away with something because it was more delicious to get away with it than it was to sit and read. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I really love Poison for Breakfast. It's a marvelous book. And as I said, it's got a lot of serious ideas in it, and it is hilariously funny, laugh out loud funny.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I find that's how conversations are often with, I mean, my favorite conversations are all like that. Often the conversation will be with a young person, though, you know, but if you walk up to a young person at a party and you say, I was looking at this chandelier that's hanging above us and it looks like it could fall and crush us at any minute, then you'll have a very interesting conversation about death that will be quite serious and also funny at the same time. also possibly be asked to leave the party, but those are the breaks.
Well, congratulations on this book, and thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I hope you come back.
I would delightfully come back. I'll call first so you don't have to just sit here on Zoom waiting for my return. We'll make an appointment. But I would love to return. It's been charming talking with you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.